Today on The Grave Talks, the haunted USS Hornet. Take the drive past Oakland or up to Bay Farm Island in California, and you'll find yourself on Elmita Island. The island is home to several decommissioned U.S. war vessels from a bygone era, many of which now spend their days basking away in the hot California sun, slowly rising and falling in a sea of salt water. Not exactly the perfect environment for preservation. Nonetheless, the haunted USS Hornet resides in these waters, as does a live crew that works tirelessly to tell the story of an American legend and the crew who sailed her. That same crew, who to this day, although deceased, may still be on board the haunted ship, if the stories are real. The story of the USS Hornet does not begin with ghosts. It had a long, rich history at sea, playing pivotal roles in many battles and in the U.S. Air and Space Program. It's now home to a museum that recounts its impressive history. Although she was attacked 59 times, the USS Hornet was never severely damaged. What an amazing feat for such a vessel. The ship itself is responsible for destroying more than 1,400 Japanese aircraft in World War II. While her crew remained relatively unscathed, she indeed was surrounded by death and destruction. Her thousands of crew members witnessed the best and worst humanity has to offer. She sits in the dock as a relic of a time gone by. Salt water slowly eats the paint off her hull as visitors walk through her halls, trying to get a feel for what life was once like on board. Many of her visitors have been lucky enough to get more than just a story or a picture. Several walk away, having witnessed the spirit of one of the many brave men and women who once walked her deck, yet no longer walk the earth.
The actual history goes back to 1775. The first ship to be named the Hornet was the first ship that we acquired back in 1775 when our Continental Congress declared the Continental Navy duly formed at the Independence Hall in Philadelphia, 13th of October, 1775, and the first two ships called the Hornet and the Wasp. And since 1775, there's been eight ships to be named Hornet. The second one was in 1802, third was 1805, 1814, 1865, 1898 was our sixth ship to be named Hornet. Our seventh ship was the first aircraft carrier to bear that name, and she was the USS Hornet CV-8. She was commissioned on the 20th of October in 1941. She was a Yorktown-class aircraft carrier. And 6 weeks after she was commissioned, we were attacked by the Japanese. Pearl Harbor, December 7th. 6 days after that, a guy named Adolf Hitler declared war upon the United States on the 13th of December in 1941. So we were actually fighting two wars on two fronts. The CV-8 then, she was doing her sea trials, and was an admiral, I don't remember his name, but he was walking on the tarmac and on a naval air base in Florida, and was pondering the fact that we'd just been attacked by the Japanese, and morale was kind of down. We were kind of stretched a little thin. Things are not going well for America and the world. Germany and Japan were being very aggressive, and it was not a good time on this planet. And sadly, that was kind of how the world was evolving to that point. A lot of battles, a lot of war, a lot of conflict, a lot of frustration, anger, hatred. What a cauldron of obsessed almost. But here we are in World War II. This admiral spotted aircraft that were B-25 bombers on the tarmac, and he had a thought. I wonder if these things could be launched off of an aircraft carrier. So he made a phone call. The Hornet was brought in from her sea trials, and two of those three B-25 bombers were placed on her flight deck, and she was sent back out into the Gulf of Mexico. She went into the wind, and those planes were able to launch because of their stature, the long wings, heavy big engines. And so that was the hatching of the plan to send a retaliatory strike against the Japanese by attacking them on their homelands with 16 B-25 bombers launched off of the CV-8 Hornet. And that happened on the 17th of April in 1942. We launched all 16 planes, successfully launched. They flew at wave height altitude. When they got to the shore of Japan, they climbed to their bombing altitude. All 16 planes took out their targets, and then they headed to China. The plan was to get as deep into China when they ran out of fuel to bail. At that point, we were allies with the Chinese, and so all the surviving crew members out of all 16 planes, all 16 of them successfully launched. Out of a total of 80 crew members, 69 of them survived, which was huge. All the survivors that landed in China had a rendezvous point that they were to trek themselves to that point. As they landed and headed towards their rendezvous point, every village that they came to, the villagers and the Chinese soldiers would escort them. They fed them, and they followed them all the way to their trek. We had a couple of the survivors aboard the ship several years ago, and they told of their story of that event. And one of them said that he could also see another crew member from a different plane, often from a different direction, but heading down to the same rendezvous point that he was headed towards. And behind him, he could see all these Chinese villagers and soldiers behind them escorting the crew members. A very heart-touching story. So that was the Doolittle Raid, and that was the CV-8 Hornet. Then the next battle was the Battle of Midway in June of 1942. And we actually sank four aircraft carriers to the loss of one of ours. That was Yorktown. Then the CV-8 was in the Battle of Solomon Islands in September, and then Santa Cruz Islands on October 25th and 26th, 1940. She was hit by two kamikazes, three torpedoes, and two bombs, and she eventually sank. And that was the death of the CV-8 Hornet. The CV-12... at that time was being built, and America was in very, very serious straits at that point. We had one aircraft carrier left in the Pacific. We were the guys that were building these planes and the bombs and bullets and the tanks and the jeeps and the medicine and the rockets and torpedoes and everything. These guys were the guys that were fighting the wars. So they weren't getting all those supplies, and so we weren't. They were dying in the field. They didn't have the equipment that they needed because no one was building that. America had a secret weapon. My favorite part of the story: America's women sitting on their sofas, watching their black and white TVs, eating their bonbons while the wars were going on. That they knew something was wrong, and their husbands and boyfriends weren't coming back, and they had to do something. So they showed up by the thousands at these empty factories, and they built actually this Hornet, the CV-12, in 13 months. They built 24 of that class of aircraft carrier. These things weigh 41,500 tons of steel and machinery. And they built 24 of these things in 3 years during World War II. Our great-great-grandmas and their great-great-grand-aunts and their sisters, daughters, neighbors, mothers, daughters, and sisters saved our planet, saved our country. Her keel was laid on the 3rd of August in 1942. At that time, we had one aircraft carrier left in the Pacific, and then the CB-8 was sunk in October 1942. So in January of 1943, the President of the United States got on the phone with the Secretary of Navy, Frank Knotts, and asked Frank to get him another Hornet. He said then he'll see what he could do. The next day, the sign in front of this ship, the CB-12, which was the Kearsarge, was painted white, and USS Hornet was painted over it. She became the Hornet, and then on the record books for the U.S. Navy on the 23rd of January, 1943, she became the Hornet. She then was launched on the 30th of August, took less than 13 months to build the CV-12. She was launched on the 30th of August, 1943. She then set her first Navy record by having the shortest maiden voyage of any ship in Navy history. She was then commissioned on the 29th of November, 1943. When she was commissioned, she was blessed by a priest, rabbi, and a minister. When the minister blessed the ship, he blessed her to God. Four ships normally weren't blessed to God, but this one was. After that blessing, she went to sea for 18 months without porting. 15 of the 18 months, she was in 59 major battles. She shot down more planes and sank more ships than any ship in Navy history, and suffered zero damage caused by enemy fire in those 59 battles. She shot down over 668 planes shot down out of the sky. That was a Navy record. 742 was destroyed on the ground, a Navy record. A total of 1,410 planes were destroyed by her crew and the planes, and that was a Navy record. She had 10 pilots make ace in one day. That was during the Marineris turkey shoot, and that was that day. To make ace, you have to shoot down 5 enemy planes in your career. 10 pilots did it in one day. That day they shot down 67 planes in one day. Those are both Navy records. 255 were shot down in a month, a Navy record. Out of original squadron 2 of 40 pilots, 28 of them aced in their career, a Navy record. She sank 73 ships, probably 37 more, and damaged over 413, a Navy record. And all those battles and all that carnage and all those records, she suffered no damage caused by any fire. No bombs hit her, no kamikazes. Allegedly, one torpedo hit the Hornet and it bounced off. Did not detonate, did not damage her hull. And out of those 24 ships that were built by the women of America, not one of them sunk during World War II.
What was life like on board the ship in active duty wartime? What was it like with the crew members living on board for such long periods of time?
Well, during the war, that was to say she had one of the highest suicide rates. Problem with the war, problem with life back then was mail. That was your only connection with the home. And so these 18 to 24-year-old sailors and soldiers, because we had Marines on board ships, it was a pretty tough time, especially out to sea for 18 months. You get letters that are usually 3 to 6 weeks old, if that. And John Deere letters were pretty common. Dear John, John Deere. So we had a lot of suicides. So a lot of the spirits we feel on the ship are some of those sailors that didn't make it off the ship. Life in a wartime, you try to make the best of it. You're in the middle of the ocean. There is nothing around you but sea, and it's pretty desolate. You're surrounded by other ships, but it's life during World War II was a scary time. War is not we human beings really weren't put on this. I don't believe that we were put on this planet to fight each other. We just never got the right formula to how to get along with each other. It breaks my heart, the human being. Over 100 million people perished. 100 million people, over 100 million during from 1914 to 1945 on this planet. 4% of our world population was gone in 30 years of battling. That's a lot of spirits in a short amount of time.
And obviously, very, very difficult time, very tragic time for many, many souls. But that wasn't all. that went on with the crew and the ship itself?
Well, in all those battles where she suffered zero damage, a few bullet holes in the smokestacks, on June 5th, 1945, just before the war ended, there was a typhoon off the coast of Okinawa on June 5th. For some reason, Admiral Halsey sent the fleet into that typhoon. Three destroyers were sunk. Two cruisers were sunk. Most of the crews of those, of both of those crafts were all of those crafts were lost. It was such a nasty storm. 60-foot waves followed by 100-foot waves went over the bow of the ship Hornet. It crushed 24 feet of the flight deck and disabled both of the catapults. One story was told that there was 22 sailors on the forward berthing area, that the door on that berthing area was ripped off by the water, and it pulled 22 sailors out for their demise, but according to Navy records, that there was no loss of life that day. So there was a conflict of stories there. But either way, as a result of that damage, this ship still had a mission to accomplish. She's the only ship during World War II to shut her engines down. We put them in reverse. We did 18 and a half knots backwards into the wind and launched planes off the stern of the ship. This was a unique, done before, never been seen before, but we were able to accomplish. They were able to fulfill their missions, launch planes, and successfully recover them by going backwards into the wind. After they completed their mission, they were ordered in for repairs on the way to Hawaii for repairs. Their orders were changed. They ended up at Hunter's Point for repairs and well-deserved rest. By the time they were done repairing the ship, the war had ended. When the war ended, Japan surrendered. They gave us their ship's logs. We went through their ship's logs, and there was one entry by a Japanese submarine commander who spotted what they thought was a new supercarrier launching planes around the 5th to 6th of June in 1945. Didn't know the name of it. They logged it in, down periscope, and on with their patrol. We went through our ship's logs, and there was no more. The Yamato was the last ship in the Japanese Imperial Navy, and she was sent on a one-way suicide mission, I believe, around the 25th of April in 1945. She was escorted by a destroyer. 2 hours after she left port looking for the fleet, the American fleet, she was spotted by the Americans. 2 hours after she was spotted, she slipped onto her side and sank. And that was the death and the end of the Japanese Imperial Navy. So they did not have any carriers left. What fooled the Japanese submarine was Japan was the only country to build carriers with the island on the port side. Ours were built on the starboard side, but when the ship was going backwards, it looked like it was going forward. Planes were going off the back of the ship, which looked like it was the front of the ship because it was going that direction, and the island was on the port side. That fooled. And so we actually had about a year or so ago, a couple of former Japanese submariners from World War II came to this ship for a visit. The story was that they never did know the name of that ship that they had spotted. But these two gentlemen from Japan were part of that crew, and they left the ship knowing the name of the ship that they spotted that day. It was the USS Hornet, affectionately known as the Gray Ghost.
Obviously, the vessel was still very much in service even after the war. Let me ask you, were there any stories or accounts of paranormal activity in those years following the war on board the boat?
Not that I'm aware of. As far as even today, here in 2017, I've been involved with the paranormal for about 6 or 7 years. And that's only through the ship. I've been on board the ship now for 16 and a half years, as a volunteer, and I'm the ship's plumber. I'm a overnight supervisor for the education and the liveaboard programs. It's just a wonderful place to hang out. It's a great old ship, but her history just transcends so many levels, and the spirits. Back when we first started talking about the ghost stories, it was more campfire-ish. There was a whole bunch of you know, people have sightings, but they really don't know what they're really seeing, and there wasn't a whole bunch of support. Unless you were considering yourself to be a psychic or of that sort. Since the ship opened as a museum, we have certain aircraft that have been, all our aircraft have usually been in battle at some point in lives, in their careers. When we first opened, we had one of our helicopters was a D-35 Seahorse, and people had sightings of a pilot exiting that every so often, putting his helmet under his arm and taking two or three steps and disappearing. And that was going on quite a bit. A number of sightings would happen that way. But people also climbing into this helicopter because the steps where this spirit would walk down were completely down. And so, to keep the people from going up there, they flipped it over and then wire-tied it to where they couldn't climb into the helicopter. Since they've done that, they haven't seen, there hasn't been any sightings of this pilot leaving the aircraft at that point.
You mentioned kind of campfire stories and accounts of the paranormal happening that were, you know, kind of hearsay, if you will. This is before the days of investigators, before the days of podcasts and shows that share these stories. What were some of those word of mouth, almost campfire type stories that were told about the Hornet?
Oh, sure. There are a couple of guys that when we first got the ship as a museum, but before she opened, there was a lot of cleaning and work to be done, a lot of painting, a lot of scraping, a lot of the guys, these were volunteers, and they gave. We're a poor museum. We're not really well located, except the pier that we're docked at in Alameda, California. Is the pier where those 16 B-25 bombers taxi nose to tail down that pier and were loaded aboard the CV-8 Hornet sitting where the CV-12 is sitting. It's a historical location, but it's in the old defunct Naval Air Station, Alameda, which is pretty much the edge of the peninsula there. So you've got to wind yourself through a tunnel, the Webster Street Tunnel, and get onto the old base, and then you got to make a left-hand turn, and you'll see ships off, and we're the last ship of where those are parked. But it's an incredible museum. Unfortunately, we're not in a great location for traffic to find us, but the people that had worked there, they would be working on down a passageway, and they'd be done for the day. And so they'd start turning off the lights as they exited down the passage. And when they got to the end of the passageway, all of a sudden they heard a click and the light came on, and they stopped and they turned around. Another click and the light, next light came on. Another click and the next light came on. They looked at each other and said, "Yeah, we've had enough. We're out of here." We had a couple of guys that were scraping paint and painting up in the forecastle area, the very front of the ship, below the flight deck, where the anchor chains are handled, and they're up on a catwalk scraping the paint and painting. And one of them got the feeling that there was something watching them, so he turns around and there was two apparitions, two sailors in white uniforms, white face, dark circles where their eyes were, leaning against the bars, looking at them. So Keith nudges his buddy to turn around. Hey, look. Turns around and they disappeared. So I looked at each other. They go, no, really, there was two guys up there. He goes, I think it's time to go take a break. So they left, went and had lunch, came back and started working some more. They moved a little bit further down, and all of a sudden, Keith got the same feeling again, and this time he touched the guy next to him. They both turned around together, and there was two sailors, white faces, dark eyes, where their circles or where their eyes were, all in uniform. They stood up, they looked at each other, turned around, and they walked into the bulkheads and disappeared. Those stories, we still actually tell those on the ship. But back then, we didn't have these devices called K2 meters, which are used by electricians these days. They're electronic magnetic field sensors. So if I had a circuit and I wanted to make sure that there was power in there, I could pick one of these things. I don't have to touch the wires. I just have to bring this meter up close to the wires, or even you don't have to actually touch the copper part. You can touch the insulation. You don't get shocked. But these things can sense that there's power in it, or turn off the breaker. All right, there's nothing in there. You can safely start working. If someone comes along and turns that breaker on and you're away from that, and all of a sudden your meter just jumps up to red, you know that someone's just energized that circuit. Don't touch it, because you could die. That's what these meters do. But for some reason, especially on our ship, they go crazy. We do tours on the ship. We go to different, you know, we do a 3-hour evening tour on the ship. Runs about $35-$40 per person. And we take them to these different areas for about 20 minutes, and then we move to another location. Sometimes you get all sorts of interactions. Sometimes the flashlights turn on and off. Occasionally they roll. I've had my flashlights roll 3 times now in the 7 years I've been playing with that. It's the best. It's the best.
When the stories of the paranormal first started coming up, I guess in a more mainstream way to the public to be shared beyond just a, did you hear about this? Did you hear about that? What was the reaction from folks? How were the stories taken as they were more publicly shared?
Well, our program has been a youth program primarily. The Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts and Brownies basically were our customers, and their families, their parents and their chaperones. They actually got to come and spend the night on the ship. That's what's kept us afloat. We feed them dinner and breakfast, give them tours of the ship, and then from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock, we do ghost stories for those that want to go listen to ghost stories. Those that don't want to, we show them a movie, or they can go to the berthing area and call it a night. So that's the program. But back when we first started, those were the stories that we would tell, and the reactions was, you know, yeah, it was, you know, kind of spooky, and yeah, they kind of believed it. And but we used to have this on a ship, especially a Navy ship, you have watertight doors, and so these are whenever you go into battle, if you get damaged, you want to kind of maintain, restrict the, if you get damaged on the hull of the ship, you want to contain that damage from spreading around the ship or filling the ship with water by putting these watertight doors and cinching them down, and that seals the compartments. We use a little pipe on these door handles, the dog ear handles, to help give you leverage to really cinch these doors down. It's called a dog ear pipe. Or pin. And so as part of the ghost stories, whenever we would tell these stories, and we believed these stories, and so we were pretty good at telling them, and people would be kind of on the edge of their seat listening to our stories, and we'd have one of our crew members have one of these pins, and this is a steel ship, and we're in a steel room, so the echo and the sound is pretty... sound effects in the room are pretty intense when it's metal against metal. So there would be a point where whoever's telling the story would say that it was so quiet that you could hear a pin drop, and that was the cue for the person or crew member to take that pin and drop it on the deck. from wherever they were standing. So it was back behind where all the kids and the adults were. So basically it was all an adult and kid program. And their reactions, even today, I sort of, even though we've got these K2 meters, and when we start telling the stories, they start going off. It's almost like an applause meter to me. If they like the story, they like the kids, the people that we're talking to, they give them a show.
Do you feel that the spirits on board the boat are happy, or where they want to be? Are they at peace? Is this where they are choosing to spend their time?
I believe that the universe is their playground. They can be wherever they want to be. They want to be here. I want to come back. The moment I cross over, I know where I'm going. I'm going to Hornet. I hang out there. It's a haven for good spirits. We've had people, psychics, do a reading on the ship that about 250 souls or spirits. I think they come and go. Nothing holds them there except their choice. Your energy. So if you think your energy belongs there, then that's where you're going to be. If you want to go see what the universe has to, like the Google, that little Google, I had a plan. When I discovered that there is a life after this, and that the universe is your playground, gravity doesn't affect energy, atmosphere doesn't affect it. You don't need food, you don't need oxygen, and you can travel at the speed of light. And then someone sent me this email about this lady laying in the grass outside of a Google restaurant, and all of a sudden the caption underneath it goes 1 meter, 10 meters, 1,000 meters, 10,000, and it zooms away and it goes all the way through the universe to the outer edges of the universe in about 2 minutes. And then it stops after it gets to like 10,000 light years or a million light years away from where you started. Then it turns around, comes back, goes back to that lady laying in the grass, goes into her eye, into the retina of her eye, into the blood vessel there, to the white corpuscles, blood vessel, blood cells in there, gets DNA, finds an oxygen molecule, and to the center of the nucleus of an oxygen molecule, going down to the microns, and then captions that. So it went both ways, and then it reversed and comes back out. So thank you, Google. Now I don't have to, as a spirit, I have to go travel to see what it looks like. I've seen it. And if I want to see it again, I can click it right now on my laptop, and I can go to the edge of the universe and come back in a couple of minutes.
A special thanks to Robert from the USS Hornet for taking the time to share his stories with us today. For more information on the USS Hornet, you can visit their website at uss-hornet.org. It's going to wrap up today's episode of The Grave Talks. If you like our program, let the world know about it. Please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, iTunes. Share it on social media. Let your friends and family know this is a great place to hear some ghost stories. That is how we keep this show alive. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.